It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Less than 40 days until the 2016 general election. Of course, we deal with politics often on this program, and we invite candidates to share their views. Back in August, you may remember, we spoke on this program with former Lieutenant Governor Patty Judge, the Democratic Party's nominee to unseat six-term Senator Charles Grassley. Next week on this program, we'll hear from Libertarian candidate Charles Aldrich. And today we're hearing from Senator Charles Grassley himself. He joins us live. Iowa's senior senator has been serving Iowa in the upper house of Congress since 1981. Senator Charles Grassley, welcome back to the program. Let's get right to some news from yesterday. Congress overwhelmingly rejecting President Obama's veto of legislation allowing relatives of the victims of 9/11, the attacks on 9/11, to sue Saudi Arabia, the first override of this presidency about 4 months before the end of Obama's second term. I wonder if you'd explain your position on this vote, specifically the concerns that this could seriously hurt U.S. national security interests, possibly make the U.S. vulnerable in other courts around the world.
It will not make us vulnerable in other courts around the world because it explicitly prohibits lawsuits arising from acts of war. That was one of the issues that was brought up. So claims that the law would lead to lawsuits against soldiers and diplomats is very misplaced. Without this legislation, courts would block terrorism-related claims that Congress intended to permit. And it simply enables families of 9/11 victims to pursue justice against those who sponsor acts of terrorism. And it's got to be on U.S. soil. And it does it by preventing them from invoking what lawyers would call sovereign immunity in cases involving attacks on U.S. soil. So it will not in any way allow individuals to be sued. It's only when it involves the Saudi Arabian government.
Join our conversation, Senator Charles Grassley, with us live, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or 1-866-780-9100. Just less than 20 minutes to spend with Senator Grassley, but we'll try to get in as many listener questions and comments as possible. Senator, this was emailed to us from Greg in Waterloo. It gets to the heart of what I'm hearing from many Iowans in this very divisive campaign season, and I'll just read this to you from Greg in Waterloo. I voted for you in the past and enjoyed the Harkin-Grassley exchanges in the Senate. I understand and accept your desire for a conservative Supreme Court. That is your choice. Are you ready to take responsibility, Greg writes, for your connection to a candidate that espouses xenophobic, racist, misogynist, and birther ideas? Even though I have disagreed with you, I have respected your conservative views. He goes on, if you do not embrace the same views as Donald Trump, then you need to say it and tell the people you cannot vote for this man. What do you say to Greg from Waterloo?
Well, in regard to the court decisions, remember it's a two-step process. A president nominates. The president can nominate whoever he wants to. The Senate confirms. It's a two-step process. And I will make my decision on who's put on the court when the president makes a nomination, whether it's a Democrat president or a Republican president. But it's as simple as what I said. A president nominates. The Senate confirms. It's a two-step operation. There's no obligation to go beyond what we think ought to be done.
Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton has now said that if elected, she would look widely for candidates rather than to commit to Merrick Garland. I wonder if this would put you in the position to perhaps then hold hearings for Merrick Garland in the lame duck session after the election, if she should be elected and be president-elect.
No, we're very clear that we follow the precedent set by several people before we made this decision. You can go back to the Lyndon Baines Johnson nomination when senators said in the last year of that presidency that the new president should make the decision. So Nixon filled that position. We have the statements by then Senator Biden, Senator from New York made those statements as well, that we ought to, Senator Reid and Senator Schumer made similar decisions that in the last year of a presidency, you should let the new president make the decision. And that's kind of where we are, because you can't have one rule when you have a Republican president, another rule when you have a Democrat president. So we decided that who's ever elected in November would make that decision after January 20th. 2017.
Mm-hmm. Back to Greg in Waterloo to make sure he gets an answer to the question he had. He said, if you do not embrace the same views as Trump, then you need to say it. Do you embrace the same views as Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's as simple as this, that sometimes you agree with any president, sometimes you disagree with any president. And it's the same way with Donald Trump.
In large part, you agree with his values, his character, his vision for the country?
What I generally, I look at specific issues, but it really doesn't matter to me what a president thinks. He's head of the executive branch. I'm a member of the legislative branch. We have separate constitutional powers, and I will exercise my powers and my judgment within the powers that the Constitution gives me. When I agree with the president, I agree with the president, and when I don't agree with the president, then you have disagreement. Pretty simple under the Constitution.
You said it doesn't really matter what the president thinks?
From the standpoint of my role as a legislator, I'm a member of an independent branch of government.
But you support Donald Trump, so
yeah,
you must support his thinking, right?
This is basic government.
Mm-hmm.
Basic government. We have a tripartite system of government. I have my jobs to do, and whether you have a Republican president or a Democrat president, sometimes you agree with them and sometimes you don't agree with them. And maybe in a lot of instances, my disagreements have maybe been sometimes greater with certain Republican presidents, let's say like Reagan, on how much money ought to be spent on defense during the 1980s, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Just one example. I led the battle to freeze the defense budget in the 1980s when we had a Republican president, when there was just a minority of Republicans in the United States Senate that felt the same way I did, but we had a majority of the Senate.
I wonder, you and all other Republican members of Congress from Iowa have been steadfast in your support of Donald Trump. Do you think the fact that Iowa's Republican leaders are all endorsing Trump is one of the reasons that he is doing relatively well here in Iowa, according to polls, even leading Hillary Clinton in many of the polls?
I had this discussion this morning with some people, and it's kind of an anomaly from our point of view when you figure that we Republicans have only carried Iowa 2004 in the last five or six presidential elections, and it's really difficult for me to explain. And I'm not sure that I get an explanation from people that bring it up. And you obviously asked the question because you would like to know, and I'd like to figure it out too. But I guess from the standpoint of not agreeing with Hillary Clinton on very many things, that I'm glad that we might have a chance of having a Republican president.
I guess to simplify the question, which I think you've hit the nail on the head there, is do you think your support has helped Donald Trump in the polls here in Iowa?
No, I don't.
You don't? Why would you endorse or support a candidate if you don't think he's helped in polls?
No, you're the two questions you're asking me have no connection.
Explain that.
Well, explain it. You asked me what I thought about his standing in Iowa.
And if the endorsement of all the Republican members of Congress had anything to do with his relatively good showing in the polls currently.
I'm not sure that all the members of Congress have endorsed him.
All Iowa Congress members who are in the Republican Party haven't they?
I don't know for sure.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the other issues that we've seen in the news, if we could. We have about 10 minutes left here. I wonder if you could comment about, the EpiPen controversy. You wrote to the maker of the EpiPen, Mylan, with questions about the product's price increases after hearing concerns from Iowans. You said you felt unsatisfied with the response you received. It didn't answer all your questions. Tell us, what is the best way to curb the rising price of pharmaceutical costs?
Well, first of all, you've got to look at EpiPen, that they have a monopoly, and they shouldn't have a monopoly. And if they didn't have a monopoly, I'll bet the price wouldn't be as high as it is. And so one of my letters was to the FDA about any alternatives that are in the pipeline to come up to compete with Mylan on their product, and I think that that would go a long ways. And I believe that we need to make sure that the price is legitimate, and I don't see the price going up in 7-year period of time by 400 and some percent as legitimate, particularly when the basic product within EpiPen has been around since 1901, and that we need to raise these questions legitimate. And they've already responded not in a very adequate way, because they should just reduce the price. But the fact that they're bringing online another product less expensive to compete with it almost within 2 weeks after we raise the question, the fact that they give a $300 rebate to certain people is understand that it's very difficult for them, I think, as well. And I think the best thing to do is to get FDA moving on additional competitive product. I think that's the way to reduce the price. Without a doubt, I think that they have taken advantage, a very serious advantage, of a product that's badly needed for people that have allergies to peanuts and nuts.
Mm-hmm. U.S. Senator Charles Grassley joining us live. We have a little less than 10 minutes left. Let's try to get in as many listener calls, emails. Caleb is joining us from Ankeny. Hi, Caleb. We're short of time, but please, let's hear your question for Senator Grassley.
Yeah, shot. I got a question for you. Do you support the Bakken pipeline? And if so, do you support eminent domain abuse of people that pay taxes on their land and then corporations come in and just abuse their land? Do you support that?
Well, you're talking about something. If you ask me about the pipeline carrying oil from Canada down to the Oklahoma, I voted for that because that comes within the realm of the Congress of the United States to make that decision, because it costs the national border. The pipeline you're asking me about doesn't cross the national border, and it's within the jurisdiction of the four states to make that decision. So I'm not involved in that decision, and I guess that when I know the importance of pipelines to deliver, if you see a map of pipelines in the United, in Iowa, there, or the entire United States, they're all over the map for a particular state. In fact, I have a pipeline going across my farm as just one example, you wonder the controversy of it. But I think if I had a farmer digging up my farmland, I'd be very concerned about it as well. But as long as state law is followed, and it's entirely a state decision, unlike the pipeline from Canada down, carrying oil from Canada down to into the United States, that's a federal issue. What you're talking about is a state issue, and I find it pretty difficult for me sitting in Washington to question decisions by the leaders of four different states to go ahead with it.
Senator Grassley, on an ag-related question that I also put to Patty Judge, I'd like to have you address
sure.
water quality. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, also former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, has urged Iowa lawmakers to act on water quality, saying that lawmakers should, in his words, lock the door and not come out until they've got a plan. How should lawmakers act to improve water quality in Iowa, across the nation? Should the state or federal government regulate to solve the problem?
Well, the federal government already regulates the problem.
But down to a certain extent, not down to these smaller streams that feed into our lakes and rivers, right?
Well, the extent to which the water quality is regulated, the head of EPA at the federal level was at the state fair 3 years ago, and she made a statement that the plan that Iowa had in place I don't know whether she said it would work or that it was plausible or what she said, but is very approving of it. And so Iowa moves ahead. If at any time Iowa violates federal law, the national federal EPA can step in.
Yesterday, after nearly 7 months, the Congress agreed to allocate over $1 billion to help fight the spread of and the effects of the Zika virus, not affecting us here in Iowa yet, but certainly in Florida and some other southern climes, Senator Grassley. The deal part of a broader agreement to continue to fund the government after the fiscal end year ends on Friday. Why did this get tied up in such a partisan fight when it all sides agree it is a public health emergency?
It's pretty hard to explain when all 54 Republicans supported it. It's probably a question that's more appropriate for Democrat senators than it is a Republican senator to answer that, because I don't know really what the scheme was behind Democrats not voting for it. That's where you'd have to go for your answer.
But
we did finally get a bipartisan agreement to move ahead.
Yeah, because of the, I understand that the language was dropped barring funding from going to Planned Parenthood clinics, right?
Well, then, that was a House of Representative position, and you would have to, there were several things that were put in to the House of Representatives on that issue. The Senate agreed to take those out. The real issue is getting at the Zika issue, and this finally did it, thank God.
Let's go to John in Rhodes. John, welcome to our program. Running short of time, but we're glad to have you on the program with Senator Charles Grassley.
Yeah, John, glad to have you here. I'd like to hear your question.
I wondered about term limits. It seems to me you've said you have supported them in the past, and now they didn't affect you, or why they didn't.
Well, if they'd gone into effect, they would have affected me. I voted. We've had the vote once in the years I've been in the Congress, and maybe that once is the only time it's ever been voted on in the entire 230 years of Congress, and I voted for it.
Mm-hmm. Can you say when?
Okay,
you
doesn't affect yourself, huh? As part of your.
Well, it would affect me if it got to be part of the Constitution. It'd affect everybody.
Yes,
mm-hmm. The larger question, Senator Grassley, when do you plan to retire? You're obviously in it for another 6 years. Should you win re-election, when would be the time for you to call it quits in the Senate?
I think you ought to ask me after this election, because I got to be in the Senate for another term before that question would even be applicable.
Mm-hmm. Let's field another listener question. This is from Amanda, who would like to hear about your bipartisan efforts. She writes, I've been hearing mostly about your controversial positions. I'm not happy with a lot of decisions regarding those, especially blocking the Garland hearings. The senator has been an asset to the state in the past, but I feel like I need more reassurance that he's working for the state of Iowa first and the Republican Party second, instead of the other way around, in order to vote for him again. That's from Amanda.
Yeah. Why would she think that for all the years I've been in the United States Senate, I hold town meetings to be in touch with the people of Iowa, not only through mail, not only through telephones, but actually face-to-face meetings. So I think the best thing to say to her would be that the 30 bills that have come through the Judiciary Committee since I've been chairman have been all bipartisan bills. Not a single partisan bill has come out of that committee. The tax relief that I worked out with Democrat Senator Baucus when I was chairman of the Finance Committee would be another perfect example of that. The False Claims Act that I worked out with Democratic Congressman Berman a generation ago has brought $48 billion back into the federal treasury. Senior citizens have a prescription drug program because I was chairman of the chairman of the Finance Committee when we established Part D of Medicare. And then I'll give one more example. Senator Kennedy's dead now, but he and I worked for 6 years to get the Family Opportunity Act passed. Okay. So nothing gets done in the United States Senate if it isn't somewhat bipartisan because of the 60-vote requirement.
We have 1 minute left. I'd like to make sure we get a question on our flooding here in 2016 for you. Money for flood protection in Cedar Rapids, Senator, has been approved but not allocated. What can you do to ensure money for flood protection gets approved?
Yeah. Thank God it's not a big lift for this reason, that when we have disaster relief, there's money put in at the beginning of the fiscal year. You never know what you're going to need for the next 12 months. But if it runs out during that 12-month period of time, it's generally replenished without any controversy whatsoever.
Okay, so you see that working through Congress easily?
I can't say it any more plainly than I have, and it's been that way all the years I've been in the Congress of the United States.
Okay, thank you very much, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley, joining us live. We appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us on River to River.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with a South Korean, very interesting woman, Suki Kim. In 2011, she posed as a missionary and taught English to the sons of North Korea's ruling class. Her book, Without You, There Is No Us, is an account of the time she spent teaching in North Korea. She's coming to Iowa to speak, and we'll speak with her in just a few minutes. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest today has experienced the world's most isolated and secretive society from the inside. In 2011, Suki Kim posed as a missionary and taught English to the teenage sons of North Korea's ruling class. In 2014, she published Without You, There Is No Us. That's an account of the time she spent there, and it's an account she risked her life to retrieve. On October 9th, she'll be speaking in Iowa City. It's a talk sponsored by the Iowa City Book Festival. Suki Kim, welcome, joining us via Skype from Seoul, South Korea. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us how you, a native of South Korea, came to teach English to the sons of North Korea's ruling class.
Well, I'm a writer and a novelist and a journalist in America. I normally live in New York City. I went there back in 2002 and covered it for a long time and researched it. And, you know, it was pretty clear that there's just no way of getting the truth about what's going on inside the country unless you're embedded. So I went there for about five times, and finally I found out about an organization run by the evangelical fundamental Christians around the world that were building this university in Pyongyang for the sons of elite. So I joined them, passed off as a fellow ESL teacher and a missionary, and then I ended up living there in 2011, which ended up being Kim Jong-il, the last great leader's final year. I mean, I was in Pyongyang when he died. And I spent every day with these young men, age 20, about 270 of them in a locked military compound for 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what these young men, these sons of the North Koreans' leaders, what their sense of the world view, what they thought of the rest of the world and North Korea's place in it.
You know, I mean, having covered it for about a decade, I had interviewed a lot of defectors who come from the bottom rung of society. We're always under the impression the elite know far more and have a lot more. What I found was that they were under absolute control. They really had no idea what was going on in the outside world. And the little they did know, they couldn't express them because they were under a constant watch. They lived in fear. Their lives were mapped out 24/7. They were students of science and technology, but they didn't know the internet existed.
Mm-hmm. Until recently, North Korea has tried to conceal the very fact that the internet exists. And this was, amazingly, as you mentioned, it was called the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. You note, though, at the end of your time, you started seeing the students gaining a small... some kind of access to the internet? What was that like?
Well, I mean, they have a thing called intranet, which is not the internet. That's like a selected links, information that is a pre-selected links. They thought that was the internet. But by the end of my stay, my students were possibly catching on the fact that their internet was not my idea of the internet. Still, though, they were not allowed to ask any questions about it. And it's actually, when you have never been on the internet, it's impossible to fathom what that is. The school, they tried to pretend they had the internet by showing about 10 students sitting in front of the Google page open. But then when you talk to them, it was very clear because they would ask things like, how many movies can you watch on the internet? It was very clear that they had no idea what it was. When you think about it, it's not that surprising because, you know, all you would have to do is Google and then the myth of the great leader would break overnight.
Mm-hmm. What prevented you from telling the students how big and vast the internet was?
You know, it is such a controlled society in a minute way that we cannot fathom. The foreign teachers who were allowed in there were under specific order not to say anything to the students. We lived under a constant watch. The minder lived in the same building as the faculty right downstairs from me. His job was to watch over me. Every class was recorded and reported on. Every conversation was overheard. Every room was bugged. All my conversation with my students, I had to have meals with students every day. There was always someone recording that information. So there's just no way that you could reveal anything because not only would I probably get in a severe trouble, but I would also put someone else in danger, which in this case were those young men. So it's just a system of just constant surveillance in such a complete way. You know, North Koreans are not even allowed to travel within the country, never mind outside of the country. Every young man have to serve a military service for 10 years. You know, it's such a mind-bogglingly controlled and brutal system. There's just no way you can say anything.
Mm-hmm. Despite that, did you sense any of your students, the young men of about 20 in age, did you sense that any of them in your classes were questioning society they were born into, questioning the fabricated reality they were given?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. They were also incredibly smart at the same time. It was very complicated. You know, human beings are complicated. Sure, they're living with foreign teachers, and even though everything is under minute control, they realize something is different, something doesn't quite make sense. You know, they only learn about the great leader, nothing else. Their entire lives surround the great leader only. And however, you know, I think that little bit of glimpses of them thinking there's something wrong, it gets really squashed instantly because there's like minders always around. And also they have a thing called Daily Unity Critic, which is a once a week collective meeting where they have to report on each other. So, you know, this idea of getting in trouble because someone's always watching, even if you question slightly, it does make you completely stop asking further. You know, they were excellent at changing the conversation anytime. And it's not anything gigantic. It would be something like how many channels of television, because they only have one channel, and which only shows programs about the great leader. And they would, you know, curious enough to be able to say, how many channels do you have in America? But then they'll change the subject, because if the answer is 100 channels, for example, then that means a choice. And I kept repeating, yes, well, we have a choice of, 100 TV channels. All that was to try to, I guess, somehow relate to them that we have a choice in the outside world. But that's as far as the conversation would go, because they would quickly realize this is not something they should touch because someone's watching.
If you just joined us, Suki Kim is my guest, author of Without You, There Is No Us. She posed as a missionary and taught English to the teenage sons of North Korea's ruling class. And this book published about her 2011 experiences. It was published in 2014, her experiences back in 2011. I wonder, you had this goal of revealing North Korea's ruling class through its youth, through this experience. What did you see as your goal in regards to your students? Did you, in any way, could you in any way give them hope of change in the future?
I think my job as a writer, North Korea is the most, not the world doesn't know anything about North Korea, but because of that, it is so misunderstood, meaning those people, you know, all we know is this a crazy dictator and a nuclear threat, and the rest of what's going on in there is just famine and gulag, and there's just no picture of humanity. Like, people are not able to look at them as human beings. There's 25 million people inside, and I think I needed to, and I did, you know, research and covered it, went there 5 times. I think I kept trying to get to some sort of bottom of that world as much as I can to create a humanized portrait. Like, these are real human beings stuck in the most brutal system in the world, as the UN has declared. It's a really like a crisis point, and I needed to bring for us outside really more, because there's not much they can do inside, that we need to look at that world and realize people are stuck there, and they've been stuck there for 70 years. And they're real people. I mean, these kids were lovely. You know, they were just like 19, 20-year-old young men. I mean, they might have to act like they're soldiers or the great leader, but at the same time, they giggle, you know, whenever any talks about girls are mentioned. So I think that complexity of what it's like to be a human being and yet having to live in North Korea under this cult ideology of Kim Jong-un, I think that I needed to somehow relate that to the rest of the world.
But wait a minute.
Their story is never told.
Right. But to your students, what obligation did you feel toward your students?
I think the most I could do there was to protect them, meaning I didn't want to, you know, make sure that they're protected, that nothing, no harm would come to them. That was just always a cautious. What I mean, there's nothing I can tell them, because anything I tell them could only be bad news. Either they'll question the system and somehow that would create something horrible for them, or anything I say and they say could get them in trouble. I mean, just in every way. So I think my goal there, as much as I wanted to tell them so much about the outside world, it was really walking on ice, because I knew, I think the horror of North Korea is realizing how brutal it is once you're inside. And I think that knowing the consequences, I just was always torn. You know, of course I wanted to tell them about the internet and the world outside and the fact you live your free life outside, but that just wasn't possible in that system. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I would slip a little bit, but then, you know, always it was just a dilemma after dilemma.
I was interested to read that North Korean authorities gave you, Suki Kim, and your fellow English instructors permission to show films such as Avatar and Harry Potter. Why do you think they allowed that? I mean, it shows so much technical ability that the North Korea does not have, for instance.
You know, they're actually not allowed any films at all except March of Penguin and Lion King. But because, of course, those don't show the real world, they finally, the missionaries, actually they wanted to show Narnia, since that had their missionary purpose, which was actually rejected by North Korean staff. You know, the school was also, there was a North Korean staff in charge of everything, that we had to get every lesson plan approved by. But there, one of the agreements the school had was that there would be a movie day. And it was a debate on the movie day, the selection of the movie. Ended up being Avatar because Avatar is science related. Remember, this was a school on science and technology. Also, Avatar doesn't really show the real, what the real threat is if you show like a movie where you see streets of Manhattan or Paris. Like, they don't want to see that. But something like Avatar is kind of a made up reality. So that passed. Same thing happened with Harry Potter because it's also a fantasy world. I was able to show that to my students, just one group. And, you know, it was amazing because they'd never seen anything like it. Because all they ever get as far as movies are just the great leader movies.
Mm-hmm. Has there been, have you known of any reaction the North Korean leaders have had to the book that you published in 2014 with all these details, little known details of North Korea, life inside?
Well, when the book was coming out, I was just under getting constant threats related to me through the school. Because school exists because the university is in, they collaborate with the Kim Jong-un regime. Now Kim Jong-un regime, then Kim Jong-il regime. They've, you know, poured in over $35 million just to build the school and a lot more to operate and God knows how much more money under the table, really, for them to function in North Korea. So the school is kind of the, you know, the voice of the North Korean regime, and they were threatening after threats. So with that kept continuing, they wanted me to send them this manuscript before or escalate the tension. You know, that just continued, the hassle and the harassment. But, you know, I wasn't, you know, I'm still alive.
Suki Kim, I wonder if, based on what you know in teaching English to the sons of North Korea's leaders, do you think North Korea would have any hesitation launching missiles with nuclear warheads? And they've shown they can do this now at the South Korea or at Japan if they felt backed into a corner?
Well, I mean, that's a suicide. So, I mean, I don't think that. Yes, North Korea is insane, meaning brutality from our angle is insane. But from their angle, it's just brutality. So when you think about it that way, that they're not going to, I don't think, dive into suicide because for, you know, no matter how brutal it is still like a system that has maintained itself so meticulously for the last 70 years. I just do not see how that can dive into this out of control nuclear war scenario, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But do you see the point I'm driving at is that the rest of the world, a lot of the rest of the world, the United States, you know, says it cannot allow North Korea to threaten the existence of your homeland, South Korea, of Japan, and the missiles they have now can carry nuclear weapons and can reach those distances.
Well, I mean, it is, I think, a real threat because, you know, it is because of the insanity level of North Korea. I don't see that they would actually use that, but because, you know, it's really like a situation that is a slop because obviously to dissuade them from using it, the rest of the world has to constantly pay them off, which is basically what's happened thus far. No, there is really no foreign policy when it comes to North Korea. That foreign policy is basically all the surrounding countries from China to South Korea to Japan to Russia to the United States kind of paying them off so that they don't use this weapon. Meanwhile, you know, there'll be dealing them, you know, whether it's Iran or whoever it is. So in every way, it's basically, it is at this point, that is their survival method. They don't have anything else. They're completely locked into a corner except their own weapon of the nuclear weapon threat. So from their point of view, you can see why they would never give it up.
Never give it up, but I guess the question is that whether they would ever use it. First strike.
I mean, I think that is not a, I mean, that is not without a realm of possibility, I guess. You know, I think it's at that point, you know, I mean, they would, it would be a suicide for them to use it. So that's not really, you know, for them, it's not really a viable solution until they're pushed absolutely to the end. So, but I don't think the world will let that happen. And it hasn't.
With your glimpse inside the North Korean society, not only that, but also the leadership, the sons of the leadership, what do you see in North Korea's future? Can this be sustained for decades longer?
You know, the world has been predicting that it was going to fall. Even back in 1990s, end of 90s, when there was the worst famine where a tenth of the population died, the world predicted North Korea is going to fall any minute. This prediction obviously has not proven to be true. You know, I went in there in 2002. I come from the, you know, separated families in South Korea. So, you know, I come from a background where I know, I guess, more than a lot of people about this country. And having closely covered it for a decade, what I found by really being inside and getting to know these boys and really falling in love with them was it was the worse than my worst nightmare, the reality I found there. Because the gulag is almost in their mind. You know, that kind of control is nothing more than the worst abuse you can think of on humanity. So then I think how do you even have a country like this in 2016? And how can anything change? Because it all functions under the biggest cult ideology that you have ever seen. That has managed itself for the last 70 years, and the biggest army in the world. And they're controlling people on such a minute level. I don't know how you can change that world, you know, because it's just covered from every angle. I don't see any hope.
Suki Kim, thank you very much for this conversation. Suki Kim is the author of Without You, There Is No Us. She'll be speaking in Iowa City October 9th, a talk sponsored by the Iowa City Book Festival. Suki Kim joining us via Skype from Seoul, South Korea. Suki, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.